Being 8 o'clock, we'll get this meeting started, and we have a quorum. So Representative Hewitt, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I have, and I would like to move them.
Representative Hewitt moves the minutes to approval of the minutes for February 14th, Valentine's Day, 2019. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Welcome to our committee. And again, it was a great presentation that was put on yesterday. We all enjoyed it. And also want to welcome to your last day of work before your retirement.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Now, I introduce yourself for the tape, and you can proceed with your presentation.
I will do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And again, thank you for yesterday. It was a wonderful experience for us, and we hope that we can do it again. My name is Edward Fairbanks. I am, as the chairman said, sliding on to retirement, got roped back into being the interim director for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. I've served the state under the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency 40 years ago, was the director of the Leech Lake DNR for 10 years, Bureau of Indian Affairs as a natural resource specialist in law enforcement for 6 years, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency as a tribal liaison for 24 years. I retired at 5 o'clock, and I accepted the job as the Minnesota Department of Transportation liaison at 5:35. So I lasted 35 minutes in my first retirement. I'm shooting for an hour this next time. I'm here with staff from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and we wish to sincerely thank you for this opportunity to do an overview and welcome any questions as the chair so decides. As you learned yesterday, we have 11 sovereign nations in the state of Minnesota, 7 reservations that are Chippewa, and 4 that are Sioux communities. Also, that's not depicted on the map, and I will fix that next time, is that we have 160 acres of tribal trust lands of the Ho-Chunk Nation, which are Ho-Chunks of Wisconsin. In that fact that, as you heard yesterday from the Red Lake Nation, trust lands are lands that are federally have federal jurisdiction. So as MnDOT, if we were going to do something that would affect the right-of-way, we would have to actually take our commissioner and go consult with the Ho-Chunk Nation in Wisconsin. The next slide shows where those 11 tribal nations are. For the record, the Ho-Chunk Nation lands are down by La Crescent, and it shows you the ceded territories. The reason we show the ceded territories is that 1854 has already been court-proven, 1837 has been court-proven, 1855 is in court now. The reason I state that is that with the reservation lands in 1854 and 1837, even though tribes are less than 2% of the population, we have a jurisdictional interest in about 42% of the state. The Indian Affairs Council was established in 63. Our authorizing authority is 3.922. Our basic and most important function is to be a legislative liaison between the state of Minnesota and the 11 tribal nations when going towards some sort of common state legislation. Also, we work very closely with the tribal liaisons. Under 1310, we've gone to 9 executive branches have now tribal liaisons. Non-executive branches such as the Department of Commerce have their own liaison. EQB is working towards a tribal directive, meaning instead of being able to adopt 1310 and hiring a liaison because they're 5 people, they'll have a directive that helps them deal government to government using 1310 as the basis for that. One of the major roles of Indian Affairs is we help facilitate the governor's annual tribal summit, where the governor and the 11 chiefs sit down and have a meeting, and they talk sort of as you folks did yesterday on what are the tribal priorities, what are the tribal needs, and then the governor, vice versa, talks to them about what is the state's needs and how do we work collectively. The structure, as you'll see, is that the board chairman is Robert Deuce Larson. You met him yesterday. We then have a voting committee. I am the interim director. I am hoping that we'll have a director very soon. We have Shannon Gijic, we have Melanie Franks, Mr. Jimmy Jones, and Melissa was not able to join us today. In the Indian Affairs, the voting members are the tribal governments. You'll see that Upper Sioux is not participating in this. When we make a decision, we go meet with Upper Sioux Sovereign and talk with them about this. They've chose to withdraw from Indian Affairs, and we're hoping that they'll come back to join us. The board itself is, we have the commissioners from the 12 executive branches. We have the governor's representative, two state senators, and two House of Representatives members. One of the more important functions of Indian Affairs is to help deal with the issues of the urban native community, and we have a subcommittee. That subcommittee helps us understand the needs of the urban native community. Minneapolis-St. Paul has the largest, or the second largest Native American urban population in the United States. Culture resource is one of the main functions of Indian Affairs, and in that we have it's very emotional, very difficult, but one of our main initiatives or functions is to gather human remains. We get them from people that drop off boxes of human remains, this is, believe it or not, at our office. Unintentional discoveries, it's an incredibly difficult thing, and Mr. Jones has been doing this for 22 years, and he is our lead in that. We work very closely with the Office of State Archaeologist. We share the jurisdiction in several activities. Our authorization is 307.08, and we're asking for some amendments to that this year. We also have the Field Archaeology Act, and we also do Public Law 10160, which is the Native American Graves and Protection Repatriation Act. Another thing that has been crucial is language revitalization, and we have been working with funds from the Legacy Amendment and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Funds. In that, we've used $2,340,000 to do 21 grants throughout the state, and you'll see the list that we've given those grants to. And we also have a very vital volunteer language working group, and this is made up of Ms. Fisher.
11 delegates from the 11 sovereign nations in the state of Minnesota.
And in that, they help us understand how to improve the revitalization of the Dakota, Lakota, and Ojibwe languages. Another function that Indian Affairs has undertaken and has been received very well is Why Do Treaties Matter? It's an exhibit explaining how treaties became about, what happened with the treaties, and what life is like today. And yesterday when we were up having lunch, you saw the permanent display that is on your walls. But this has been shown since 2012 to about 80,000 folks. It travels around the state of Minnesota. We have the tribal state relations training that was talked about by the chairs yesterday, where we've now Chad is a great guy, but he's not a numbers guy. We're a little over 2,500 people rather than 2,300 that we have been training. In Executive Order 1310, it requires training to help folks understand Indian country and how, as a state employee, do I function within Indian country. And in that, excuse me, it's very important to understand treaties. And so what we do is we have this display there. And we actually give them time in the day, almost 2 days of training, to actually go through, read these, and then we test them on it. So this year our priorities are that we are going to look for more continuity. So we're going to ask that our lobby change so that the chair can serve 2 years rather than 1 year. We're looking to add to the board the DPS, the Office of Higher Education, and Department of Commerce, who I served for 8 months as their liaison during the pipeline work. We're hoping that the law will mandate that governor and commissioners attend the board meetings. I served my commissioner, Charles Zelli, on this board, and when he is there's a tremendous difference in tone when a tribal leader speaks to his counterpart rather than me as a staff person. Indian Affairs assists the executive branch and agencies and tribal liaison hiring. One of the things we found is, as was discussed yesterday, the card carrying, the quantum. And in the state of Minnesota, you can self-declare yourself as Native American. when you're hiring a liaison, one of the most important functions of the liaison is to take the unfiltered voice of the commissioner directly to the chief to deal with a specific matter, and vice versa. And you cannot do that unless you have the essence of having lived in Indian country, served in Indian country, and understand the culture. And so Indian Affairs is asked to be an active participant in the hiring of these liaisons. Then Executive 1310, excuse me, we are going to try and take the essence of that. And what I found, I served as a liaison for EQB. I worked with the Public Utility Commission, the Met Council, and also Commerce in my 5 years. What we have found is that there is a need to commonize this because we have 182 boards, commissions, offices. I work with the Office of Tourism. We would like to have the essence of 1310 basically be applied to everyone so that you would understand the culture, you would take the training, you would understand how to have a policy, all of these bases that help each of those boards, each of those agencies become effective ways of providing services to all state citizens in the state of Minnesota. Language revitalization is one of our great priorities. We will be looking to increase the grants to tribal nations, grants to immersion schools. We have two currently, but we believe that we will have more, and we're trying to help foster that. You heard about immersion yesterday when Prairie Island Nation had taken their youth up to Red Lake and immersed them in the traditional schools. You also heard about how Levi Brown and everybody has taken a kid fishing, where Levi has taken a kid maple surfing, take a kid duck hunting, take a kid ricing, all of these different activities to bring them back into our culture. We have this volunteer group that they pay their own way to our meetings, and we're going to ask for funds to help facilitate them, their attendance. The Native Heritage Language Bill and more education funds. Also, as I stated earlier, 307.08, we're looking to enhance that. Give us more authority on these unintended unintentional unearthing of human remains. We had a great conversation about 101. We had a conversation about Highway 23 yesterday, where how we're trying to fix those, but we need more teeth into 307.08. Also, as we talked yesterday, we have two people at Indian Affairs. Currently, we deal with anywhere from 800 to 1,000 permits that we must reply to the state of Minnesota, Minnesota Department of Transportation on. And if we go to this 100% state funding where we're going to apply 106 or historic preservation-like regulations to, we'll add another 600 to our staff. So on Highway 23, Jim and Melissa have been basically 80% of their time has been up at Highway 23 following that, working with that, and with the cooperation of MnDOT and Fond du Lac Nation and the City of Duluth and Office of State Archaeologist, we were targeting 5 years. We actually may be done in less than 3 years. That means that these folks, these ancestors, have been laying out there, exposed to the nature, to rain, to snow. We'll have them repatriated in 2 years earlier than anticipated. So with the additional staff, we will be able to respond to the additional 600 permits, as well as have staff that we're not going to kill them. We're running our staff overtime is unbelievable. So we're going to strengthen the authority of Indian Affairs over the cemeteries. I don't know if this board is, or this committee has heard of the Arlington Avenue in Duluth, where they unearthed 55 coffins in looking to widen the turn lane. It was a mass burial because it was an old work farm. And we now have a contract with St. Louis County because Indian Affairs has got to now sift through all the soil that was disturbed. Try to figure out native, non-native with the Office of the State Archaeologist and further define that cemetery. Where is that actual cemetery? And then protect it. Okay. Our accomplishments, Executive Order 1310. We have we have worked with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, the Office of the Governor, to put on those trainings that you heard about yesterday. We have improved the consultation of a number of state agencies and boards. We've also done hiring, assisted in hiring of two additional liaisons. Department of Commerce just hired their second liaison, and so we're very excited about that. And as said yesterday, the training that we put on was condensed, and it was very rapid. We would very much invite you and love to have you come to the state training and attend the day and a half, two-day training that we have. Listen to those personal testimonies that Tad talked about yesterday. That would be the essence of understanding what you did not learn in the school books versus the reality of what history was like. I am a son of a boarding school woman, so when my mother passed away, her last words was desperate crying that she couldn't be a good mother. Now, the answer is that when she was at the boarding school for 5 years, she sat over here at this parking lot, and her two brothers sat over here, and for 5 years they couldn't talk to each other, and they couldn't go home. You rip that person out of the society. You train this person to be different. My mother liked fighting, and she was there with Dakota and Lakota, so back then we weren't the best of friends, so she'd get in trouble for fighting. So when she came home, you were a different person. And just like they said yesterday, that Kathy Chavers from the Boys Fort Nation said, I came home and I didn't understand the language. I didn't understand the society. That is basically what we're dealing with. We hear a lot about, oh, this is 200 years old. Why is this a problem? The answer is no. It's here today. And our children, my daughter is going to school at the University of Minnesota Morris, which is a boarding school. That's the history of it. And so she finds it ironic in trying to deal with the fact that her grandmother was a boarding school and she had to listen to this as a child, and now she's going to school where boarding school existed. Under the revitalization, we have worked with the Minnesota Department of Transportation and the Federal Highway, and we have what we call the Dakota Ojibwe language signs. And as you start going onto these reservations, you're going to see these signs where it has the name on the top. You heard Chairman Jensful identify himself as the place of the yellow medicine. They're not Upper Sioux, but that's their name. So when you go to their village now, you will see that in their native tongue on top. Geographically, because of our mapping, you will see Upper Sioux. And that is a beautiful thing. I told the last committee I spoke with, I have a 5-year-old great-nephew. He speaks the language at 5 years old, and when he first seen the sign on going on to his reservation, he came and told me, he said, Gunkle, he doesn't say uncle very well, he said, Gunkle, you can't believe what I saw. And then he explained it to me. So this revitalization is true and active and very beneficial. Cultural resources, I'll jump to that. To me, that's one of the most important things. We learned a lot on Highway 101, but we had a tremendous learning experience and a high curve of learning on Highway 23, and where, as I said yesterday, if there had been one nickel of federal money, there would have been a further protection process under the Historic Preservation 106 law. Without that, we found out what it means to have 100% state funded, and we're trying desperately to help fix that through Minnesota DOT, with the Indian Affairs, with the Office of State Archaeologists, to try and prevent any more of these huge unintended discoveries until we can come back to this body after 23 will be audited, and when it's finally audited, we hope to come back to this body with realistic corrections that will help protect these in the future. We are hoping that the governor will sign a new executive order like 1310, and as I said earlier, Indian Affairs will be working towards trying to get law that would assist us in having this commonality from this point forward for all state agencies' boards. And with that, I want to thank this board.
Well, thank you, and quick questions here. And first thing I want to ask about is you talked about some changes that you're looking to get. Do you have authors for those, or are you going to wait till after the review on 23 is done and come in at a future year?
No, we have some changes, and it's in the revisor's office. Once it comes out, we will desperately be looking for authors, sir.
Thank you. And the other question I have, you're talking about grave sites. Last week we had Fort's, the Historical Center in here, and they were talking about some changes at Fort Snelling, and there was some talk about where the existing building was, that there was cemetery there in the past. Are you guys involved in that or going forward? And I see someone else being, I see a wave of friend coming.
Yeah, yes. Have Mr. Jones come up and speak about that, and then I'll also address that.
Please introduce yourself for the tape. And
good morning, members. Council. My name is Jim Jones, Culture Resource Director with the Indian Affairs Council, and I've been with the state since 1995 in its role as protecting American Indian burial sites across the state. Indian Affairs Council is working in collaboration with the state archaeologists at the site of Fort Snelling, because in the past there's been excavations being done for the improvements, and there have been disassociated human remains found in different aspects of the excavations that were completed in planning for the new visitor center and other things that were going to take place. Because they were not identified as American Indian, Indian Affairs is not currently involved with those cases. The Office of the State Archaeologist is, but because of the other additional work that's going to be planned for there, we're going to be closely monitoring that and working with OSA and Minnesota Historical Society on the future expansion out there.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, inclusive of that, Ramsey County is proposing that trolley car, streetcar, mass transit, and we'll also be dealing with that because that will require a substantial amount of excavation as well.
Representative Acom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Pyramix, you mentioned the Highway 101 issue, and that's in my district. And I used to be on the Minnetonka City Council before coming here, and we had some road plans, as you well know, that, and I will say even just from a little opinion here, that it prevented a roundabout, which I'm a little grateful for, not a huge fan. So I thank you for that. But curious about what the long-term plans of that site are and the remains there. If I think it's on county land, is that correct? Does county own the property?
Yeah, county does own the property, and it was acquired by the county for the roundabout, but because the remains were placed back into the site, the burials are still there, and the mounds were reconstructed that were impacted due to the construction of that proposed roundabout. We're currently going to be working with the Shakopee community and reseeding that this spring. We have a native prairie mix that was used on different MnDOT right-of-way projects, and then also Shakopee has used that on some of their native prairie restorations in the community, and we'll be utilizing that seed mix to replant that property at the 101 project this coming spring and summer.
Representative Acom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just wondering, are there other areas around Lake Minnetonka? I know it was a very important area to the Native American people, and wondering if there are other areas around the lake, surrounding the lake, that are identified as possible burial sites.
Mr. There are literally hundreds of places around Lake Minnetonka that have burial sites listed. When we were working on 101, I was actually called to another property directly across the bay, and was on a property where they were taking down a home and unearthed human remains during the deconstruction of that house. But also we identified new mounds that were on that property. And so we had to protect those sites, cover the remains that had been impacted due to the original house construction. And then in the record, going back to the 1970s, it listed that as a burial site, and that those remains were first uncovered back in the 1970s when the house built an addition onto the original mansion that was on the property. And so when they took the old building down, there was a location outside of it where things were identified, where human remains were identified. When we got done with the property, we mapped two burial mounds on the property, and when you look right across from 101, it literally goes across in the direction that the mounds were facing, and you go across the lake onto another parcel of land. There's an island where remains were identified back in the 1960s, and then right behind that was this ridge where these other sites were newly identified. We worked with the landowners on that. We recovered the remains, and we'll be repatriating those remains this spring in cooperation with the landowner.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Mr. Fairbanks.
Inclusive to that, one of the tools that Indian Affairs is working with is with the Office of State Archaeologists and MnDOT to develop a common database that brings Historical Society information, Indian Affairs information, MnDOT's information into a database that will be somewhat restricted because you can imagine the number of looters that we would have. Mm-hmm. But the idea is to try and bring this database together so that planners and developers mm-hmm. within the state system can have a better idea of where sites may be. And if they have an identified site, they would have the information specific to that site available to them. We're about 80% there. We're short on funding, so we're talking to Federal Highway and MnDOT to see if there's additional resources we can get to make this a more inclusive database.
And you talked about 1310, and my understanding is that the Governor Dayton's executive order is going to expire soon. Where are we in the process of getting that on a similar declaration from Governor Walz?
My understanding, Mr. Chairman, is that the new executive order is almost done, and that we're hoping to see it signed in the next month or less.
Thank you.
We're pushing, if I may, we're pushing very hard to have it where the state and the tribal governments would be in some kind of event where they could see it and together celebrate that. So,
Representative Claiborne.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fairbanks, I'm curious, once these burial grounds are discovered, is there some sort of marking? I mean, I realize that we're planting the native plants, but is there some sort of marking that is left there so that people going forward would know that, in fact, this is hallowed ground?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll ask Mr. Jones, and then I'll also repeat. So,
Not in every case. The 101 case may be different. We may be putting a monument or a marker there. With the landowners, we work with the landowners to put like a covenant in their deed so that it becomes a permanent record so that 50 years from now, our grandchildren don't have to be dealing with the same issue, and that way there it becomes a permanent record. A number of years ago, our former director worked with Association of Minnesota Realtors and had a disclosure added to a bill of sale now, so that there's now a disclosure when you sell a property, does the property contain a cemetery or a burial site? And it's so that we're disclosing that you have a property, because you can still sell a property with a known cemetery or documented cemetery, but not every case will have, say for instance, a site number, especially in more remote areas because of the possibility of vandalism or looting and things of that nature. But it becomes a permanent record in the Office of the State Archaeologist. We assign a state site number, and that gets a separate designation because it lists it as a burial, and then it becomes protected under state law.
Mr. Fairbanks.
And if I may, the other thing that we find is that the state of Minnesota, through all of our different agencies, we own a lot of these burial mounds in our properties. One of the things that we've done in MnDOT is move them either to the Indian Affairs, or we just moved a large parcel of land to the Minnesota Historical Society, who has a regional kind of education process that they're doing, where they have the Grand Mound and then they go through the Little Fork River. And so we've moved to that with the permission of the tribes to work together. And that way, they're also protected in the sense that state employees are out there checking them more than we would as a state roads program. So,
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. premature me.
Please, no.
Mr. Chair. For a few years, I've been working on precision medicine, and basically the Mayo and the U of M have quite a bit of research, and it's becoming more mainstream of where you can get a blood test and it knows what medicines you may metabolize and not metabolize. 1047 is a bill I dropped to try and get a testing program. A good example is the main anticoagulant given after a you get a stent or heart surgery. Native Hawaiians don't metabolize, that drug doesn't work for them. And so they sort of found that out by having it not work for people. And the idea behind the bill is to try and help communities that we don't have a lot of data in a cooperative effort to, involuntary effort, so that this new medical frontier can assist the tribes. And I just wanted to bring that to your attention and say if I've had some conversations with some of your government relations people, but I'd like to find out ways that we can more effectively cooperate and assist in that venue. And then also I was hoping, and I've had some discussions with some people with the Fond du Lac School and a couple other tribes about a summer internship and training for when going off to college, because my feeling is the best thing to add dreams to people's lives is if there's somebody that they know, a neighbor, etc., who has gone through and been successful. I think that's a whole lot better than, ooh, there's some person nationally that I connect with. No, it's, hey, my sister or my brother graduated with that person, and, they're a doctor,
Yes, sir.
So also I'd want to, extend if there's any discussions you'd want for that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we appreciate that. As you know, diabetes is a horrendous disease that affects our people and also affects the metabolism of certain medicines. So I think that Indian Affairs would be happy to work with you to find the right venue to get more information on that. I also agree with you 100%. One of the biggest problems we face is that Native Americans simply don't want to work for the state. It is a bad thing in our general our community. It's okay to work for the feds. It's okay to work for the tribe, but it looked down upon as working for the state. I was sent to a management school or management course 2 years ago. 41 years of service, and they're going to send me to management school. The only thing I learned out of those 2 days was that starting this year, 45% of the entire state workforce is eligible for retirement. 45%. MnDOT is having a heck of a time hiring people in greater Minnesota. Just simply are not able to find them. Not enough commercial driver's license folks, not enough surveyors, not enough whatever. And so I agree with you. One of the things that we're trying to do, Mr. Representative, is change that venue of it's okay to work for the state. So when you see guys like Levi Brown working for the state and he goes into the community and talks about it, you see Jim Jones, trying to change that philosophy. We're also doing a lot of education outreach. We have 5 tribal colleges in the state of Minnesota. You have the University of Minnesota Duluth that has a huge Native American population. Morris University has 26% is all Native. We're trying to bring those into education opportunities to show those students that these are great jobs. The state of Minnesota is not a bad place to work, and try to turn that around. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you.
I would also add that reaching out to IHS, to Indian Health Service as a partner for some of the data collection for the blood work that you're talking about. I agree also with the fact of having mentors and programs that support programs like Upward Bound that transitions high school youth into a college setting during the summer program. I'm a graduate of that myself. I first started with Indian Upward Bound in Phillips Junior High School in South Minneapolis back in the 1970s, transferred over to Upward Bound in the 1980s, and was part of Upward Bound all the way up until my 12th grade year. It's because of that exposure where I met mentors and people that taught me I could make it happen, and that I could got me transitioned to being comfortable in a college setting, in addition to giving me extra credit to help me graduate through school. So, like Ed says, I do go back to the communities and talk to young people at both the Tribal College, the Bug School, and the Cass Lake School, and talk about archaeology and cultural resource management, and give presentations to those youth every year. And also,
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Bloomington in the late 19th century, a surveyor mapped all of the known Indian mounds along the Minnesota River Bluff in the city, and the city then took the map and created a layer in its geographic information system with the location of those known mounds. And so you can superimpose it upon the property lines and advise the property owners of the location of any possible Indian mounds on their properties. Is it common for communities to have this kind of information and incorporate it into their GIS systems?
Mr. Jones.
No, it's not. And Bloomington was one of the first leading communities in the state to develop a mound management plan. Mm-hmm. Bloomington's where I first got my start mapping burial mounds was on the Bloomington Ferry Mound Group. Mm-hmm. Surveyor you speak about is Theodore Lewis, who was hired by James Hill to map burial sites throughout the state, and it's because of his data that we still have, where we have highly detailed maps and compass bearings on each of these locations. But Bloomington was one of the first ones in the state to create a mound management plan, and then later when the GIS systems were being incorporated, incorporate that into a geographic layer and added that to that. I first started mapping those mounds back in the 1980s when I first started doing archaeology. Mm-hmm. And it's those maps that we helped create that the city of Bloomington later put and imposed as a GIS layer. That's the work that we're doing with the Office of State Archaeologists and with MnDOT on creating this portal so that becomes a GIS layer that, as Ed mentioned earlier, counties and municipalities could access that layer and be able to see in real time then what they have within their counties. I want to see that expanded, though, to include townships because I had a township in one case give a building permit for sewer line connection to their district, and they gave the permit to a landowner who was allowed to go through the road, but they were not aware that the Green Lake Mound went through that whole parcel. And so when the landowner started digging for a sewer line, he unearthed the remnants of what was a burial mound that had been leveled by the township road back in the early 1900s. So getting that data to not only municipalities and planning and zoning, it's also that we get it out to townships and other agencies or other organizations where they may have local jurisdiction as well. So.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fairbanks, Mr. Johnson, I've taken a personal interest in indigenous cultures for more than 50 years, and read quite a bit about the indigenous populations here in Minnesota, and most recently I've been spending more time on studying more about the Hopi and the Havapai and the Pima down in the southwestern part of the country. But in my own study, I have found that we are all kind of tenants in time of the land. There are clear archaeological evidence of populations that preceded even indigenous tribes as we know them in Minnesota by thousands of years. My question to you is, what forensic information do you use to determine whether or not an unearthed excavation is, you know, part of the indigenous tribes as we know them in Minnesota, or are something of much longer or earlier inhabitants, and how do we treat that differently with respect to private property and ownership rights? Could you just kind of elaborate on that?
Mr. Chair.
Fairbanks. Yes, Mr. Jones.
We use a lot of forensic work, and I have a background in human osteology, and so determining cultural affiliation is the first key when you identify human remains. One of the first steps is to make sure that we work with law enforcement where the remains are found, because we have to make sure that we're not dealing with a homicide victim or a missing person case. And so making sure that that the remains are not that type of case, working with different agencies. But then it goes to a forensic anthropologist or a forensic archaeologist to determine, are the skeletal remains American Indian? And based on human osteology traits, different traits that American Indian people carry, one of our diagnostic tools that we use is the front incisors of our teeth, different measurements from the cranial, measurements of the long bones. And another thing that I look at very closely is the type of burial or where the remains came out. Is it a shallow pit? Is it a coffin burial? Is it an archaic? What's the association of possible artifacts or burial goods that are associated with the remains? I've seen cases where a backhoe took the center of a coffin out, and you could see in both wall profiles the remnants of the coffin on both sides. But when you look more closely, you could see in the wall profile and at the floor real fine seed beads from the beadwork from the beaded moccasins they were wearing that had collapsed in the grave. I've seen burials that were covered with red ochre, a red pigment, that indicated a 2,000 to 3,000-year-old burial, because the remains were covered in this red pigment, red ochre. We are allowed to take 2 carbon dates from those based on the tribal community we were working with, and those remains came back 4,600 and 4,900 years. There was copper associated with the site, and on the clavicle, the left clavicle of one of the young girls that were found, you could see copper staining on the left clavicle. So this copper spear point that was found that was 5,000 years old, or the copper as that was laying there, one of those pieces, or one of those 2 pieces, were laying on this young lady's chest and had stained the left clavicle collarbone on the individual. I've seen that with human remains, historic human remains, that had trade silver or copper bands that were ornaments, and you see that evidence. And so based on that type of information, tells us what time period we're looking at. It tells us the association, and then what community that I need to contact for determining cultural affiliation based on those types of artifacts or types method of burial, things of that nature. I've come across non-Indian remains on a site up in Rush City and or Pine City, and there was no historic artifacts with the burials. I kept saying that if these were American Indian, there would be some type of associated grave goods. These burials were very unique because they were 6 feet down in solid clay, and there was once a fur trading post. There was a mission site there. Right before we were ready to recover, they're digging a water line out to take the water away from the house because they put a new foundation under it. We worked with law enforcement because when they first found it, it was underneath the addition. So they thought old man such and such killed somebody, buried him under the addition of the house. Law enforcement and BCA would not turn it over until we found the burial, the coffin. We had square cut nails, we had coffin wood, but we had no evidence of where the coffins were until the last minute when I was cleaning the wall profile underneath this addition of this house, and I hit the remnant of the coffin that had been impacted. Those burials were mixed blood. They had came back half Caucasian, half American Indian, but they were buried in a non-Indian fashion. The last burial we recovered was a historical Ojibwe burial, and it was less than 3 feet down in the ground. And everything that should have been associated with that individual, trade silver, burial goods, all of that collapsed out of that wall at the last minute. So those kinds of cases are unique, and it's just like what Mr. Ed Fairbanks had said about the Arlington Cemetery. We're going to have possible non-Indian remains come up on that site. We will have to separate them and identify them by race and ethnicity and separate them by that, by doing those types of analysis.
And additionally, if I may, Mr. Chair, if you look on page 6 of our presentation, you'll see spirit houses. I don't know technology, so I can't change
yeah.
it. But also, I believe, and I'll look to Mr. Jones, but I believe it was in the 70s yet when Red Lake was still burying their folks on scaffolds. And so we believe that you've got to dig them up to find them when, in fact, they could be on the ground itself as another way of. So we have a whole series of things that we need to deal with as we come upon remains, intentional or unintentional. So,
yeah, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I've been in construction for decades, and I will tell you that I have found some things over the decades. Never on excavation. Usually holes or excavations, you're not even present. It's put in a big pile.
Mm-hmm.
Then on backfill, when you're spreading things out and finally spreading things, I have found artifacts like scraping tools and arrowheads and occasionally a bone which you don't know, a vertebrae in particular, that you don't know if it was an animal or bison or whatever. I mean, I suppose it would need some investigation to know, but never a discovery in terms of a whole body or set of bones, but you'd find one bone, you know, which you don't even know if it was a deer or, you know, vertebrae or anything like that. But to what extent is anybody obligated to notify somebody if you find an arrowhead or some extraneous thing other than a whole body or a grave site as such?
Mr. Chair, if I'll ask Mr. Jones, then I'd like to say something.
Mr. Jones, yeah.
Artifacts on private property are property of the landowner as it is. What changes the definition is if that vertebra that's recovered turns out to be a human vertebra. But when you first come across something, it's always better to make sure that law enforcement's called, because we want to make sure, again, that someone who didn't bury a missing person case out on private property in the cover of darkness. I've had a case on Camp Ripley up in Little Falls, Minnesota, where they leveled an area of operations to build a new, basically a wall around a compound to mimic what they would do over in Afghanistan. There was a homestead site in the middle of that property. They clear cut and leveled everything in there. They took all the vegetation and put the trees up and were burning the trees. And the stumps and the trees were burning for 2 years. And somebody observed a blinded turtle had crawled up on top of this burn pile and laid her eggs up there. And so the guy went up, wildlife specialist went up to put a little fence around it, and he looks down and he picks up a bone. He's a deer hunter. He recognizes that this is not a femur of a white-tailed deer. And what he was looking at was the upper half of the femur that had been broken off but had been burnt. To this day, we still don't know where that came from. But what was more shocking is that they had given it to an archaeologist and removed it from the site. And we had to go back and say, wait a minute, what are you doing? We had to call law enforcement. We had to come in and investigate and put the soil pile out and go through all of that with a high pressure washer to put the fire out after, of course, they waited to see if the Blandin turtle's eggs had hatched. But when they went back up there and tested it, they basically had cooked because the fire was still burning underneath the sod. The only thing we can assume is that there was a burial associated with that homestead site that was missed by the archaeologists when they did the survey. And that femur was from somebody associated with that homestead. Or it was a homicide victim, and they were put on that burn pile. We still don't know. So those kinds of cases, we always have to make sure that law enforcement is called and disidentified. I've worked with BCA up in Bemidji. I've had remains from a bear identified and looked at because they thought they were dealing with a forensic case. Why? Because there was hardware inside this pelvic bone. So what they thought they were looking at, BCA thought they were looking at a homicide victim who had went through a hip replacement. Being a former bow hunter, I recognized it as the insert of a broadhead arrow, and that the pelvic bone turned out to be a pelvic bone of a bear. And so we were able to dismiss the case and say, no, the wildlife refuge was ready to remain open and open for hunting because what they had found was a bear pelvic where a bear had crawled into the refuge, died, and they found it on the surface. So those types of cases like that, we always encourage landowners reaching out if they're not sure or have it brought. And those are kinds of cases where Indian Affairs Council receives 2 to 3 times a year cases where somebody was going through grandpa's attic and came across a box that they had collected from their property for 20 years in a farm field or digging a house foundation or a root cellar, and then they find this box of remains and then they don't know what to do with it. And then we get a phone call or a landowner calls or somebody calls, and then they show up and they're like, I found this in grandpa's attic. What do I do with it? And then I open up and there's somebody looking back at me. You know, so each case is different. Each case is unique.
Mr. Fairbanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Indian Affairs has, I believe, the only osteology lab in the state of Minnesota that deals with these specific questions of native versus non-native, and we do a lot of work with that osteology lab, and we get that funded through the state as well. So that's one of the more important things that we do. Removing remains, artifacts from public law is, or public lands, I'm sorry, is against the law. And in my history, I arrested the zoning administrator from Itasca County for doing that specific thing. So it's important that if you're doing it on your private land, that's one thing. If you're doing it on public land, significantly different. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just this has been really interesting to learn. Would you just remind me, Mr. Fairbanks, how many staff you have working for your department?
Mr. Fairbanks.
Thank you. One very old, very decrepit interim executive director, and then we have 4 other staff, 2 dedicated to cultural resources, by our language revitalization and legislative work and education. So we have 4 total.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Fairbanks. And as we heard, this level of detail and the care and just the emotional work you do, that's pretty remarkable. You're able to do that with this department, so I look forward to the legislation and the request you bring forward to this committee.
And thank you. We appreciate that great deal.
And members. Well, thank you, members, and thank you for your presentation. And we look forward to the budget this afternoon, and we'll see what the governor has in his budget.
Very good. And thank you very much, folks.
Thank you.
And members, with that, nothing else before us, this meeting is adjourned.